You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to archpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to archpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's archpodnet.com/members.
Ancient tools and burials, plants and seeds, Neanderthals.
Welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast, episode 80. I'm your host, Sarah Head, and I'm joined today with my co-hosts, Ken Fader and Jeff Card. Today we're talking about Mayan hieroglyphs. What are they? What's the history behind them? And is the language still a living one today? You ready to think critically?
You will see are a staple of archaeology.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast. I am your host, Sarah Head, and I am joined today by my co-hosts, Ken Fader and Jeff Card. How's it going, guys?
It's going swell.
Doing all right. Feeling somewhat out of sorts because it is the summer now. Ken's crazy busy. So you've got an everyday schedule, right?
Yes. Yeah, man. It's like having a real job. But we're in the field with a small crew of field school students. But we're out there every day. And today we're actually in the lab because they predicted all day torrential downpours. Which, of course, because we were in the lab, but then towards the end of the day, it rained pretty nicely. So we'll get, hopefully the weather's going to be a lot better for the rest of the week, and we'll be out there. So it's exciting stuff.
You're nicer than some people I know. We usually drive out there regardless and then wait for the rain.
Yeah, well, we've got a backlog in the lab, and I really like students not to just feel like they're digging holes, that they want. I want them back in the lab. I want them looking at the stuff as it's processed. And I want them to be able to identify what it is that they've been picking out of the ground. So it's you know, I like them to get the full experience. And so it was really okay that we spent the day in the lab.
No, that makes sense. I think that makes a lot of sense.
I've seen a lot of other people who are doing field schools on this side of the country talking about how they all stayed in for the rain too. So, but yeah, they're doing lab work.
I had a friend of mine who took a field school out in the Southwest, and they produced histograms every week of how much dirt you moved, and that was apparently how you got graded. So it wasn't about doing archaeology, it was about moving dirt, and every week it was how did your histograms look for how much dirt you were moving. That does not sound like a particular that's enslavement. That's not teaching people archaeology.
That's CRM prep right there.
There you go. I guess so.
Yeah. Whereas I'm gonna be teaching online next week, but I mean that's not teaching in the classroom. I'll be grading the things largely together, and I'm doing writing and stuff like that, which destroys any kind of semblance of a schedule. So I am glad that we have at least some sort of thing that's on a regular schedule, which is recording the show.
There you go.
So.
Well, and I'm preparing my notes for the Gen Con thing, so I'm going to be at Gen Con presenting. Huzzah!
I saw that. We should talk about that. But great.
All right. So today,
go ahead.
No, what's your last thing?
No, I was just going to say that our topic today is something that I know very little about. As somebody who does mostly prehistoric archaeology in North America, we don't have a written record. And so we don't worry about having to translate anything. We don't worry about the meaning of any written documents until we get to the historical period. So this is all really exciting and new because we're going to be talking about, ta-da, what?
We're going to talk about hieroglyphics today, which is a topic that people have requested, and I know it's really popular just in general in both pop culture and in the fringe and in archaeology, though surprisingly there are very few people that are academically versed in hieroglyphics. But fortunately, one of my co-hosts happens to know a little bit about a certain kind of hieroglyph. Jeb?
It's a moderate amount. Now, first off, I'll tell it this way. So I am also an archaeologist, and I've talked about various things, but I will say straight up, one of the things that got me not into wanting to do archaeology, but I wanted to do this, that, and the other. And then I took a course in the early 1990s in Maya archaeology. I think this is how it went. Yeah, with Jerry Sabloff. And he was not a glyph specialist. He was not an epigrapher. We'll come back to that. But I was hooked as soon as that, because as we'll talk about, that was pretty much like the center of the revolution in Maya epigraphy, was right around that time. We were the very first real, I would say, honest to God history book based entirely or almost all entirely on hieroglyphic writing about the classic Maya had come out the year before I went to undergraduate. Forest of Kings by Linda Shealy and David Dell.
Yeah. It's a wonderful book.
It is a wonderful book. I mean, it is inaccurate in a number of ways, and the picture is so much more robust than we thought. But many of the things we know, some of them were first said there, or they were first really said in various ways. More importantly, it's just a fantastic book. I mean, it's still in print, even though it is, or at least I know you can certainly buy it, even though it is not, it is sort of no longer the state of the art in terms of its history. But it was the first one to really do that. So I got very turned on to that. I took courses in undergraduate, I took courses in grad school. When I went to graduate school, I wanted to do not epigraphy, but I wanted to be blending archaeology and epigraphy together. And we'll talk more about why I think I wanted to do that. But fast forward the clock to, I want to say it was 2014. I'd have to go back and look. I was returning some artifacts to El Salvador. I had 3D scan. There's one of the Archaeology 365 episodes. I talked about this. I won't go into full detail. But it came up that I did a bit of hieroglyphs as an undergraduate and a grad student. It was an interest of mine, and I was at least okay at it. El Salvador, where I work, there are a handful of hieroglyphic things, one or two which are monuments, though they're not in sort of classic Maya. They're in something else, and I don't know if we'll get into that. It's Smithium. And there are a few portable objects. The majority of portable objects have what are called pseudoglyphs, basically things that look like writing but aren't. They just sort of look the part. And those are actually fairly widespread during the late classic period from 600 to 800, although I would say really in the 7th century, especially maybe the 8th century. And I see one. And again, I've told this story, but basically, long story short, they show me something in the museum and I just lose my mind. Not immediately. I knew it was important. It was only when I sat down, looked at my pictures, looked at my notes and started to look at this thing and go, oh, my God, this thing has a real text on it. And I got super excited. And I remember thinking to myself, not quite like this, but like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm feeling, and I almost said in my mind, like a real archaeologist. And of course, it's completely inaccurate because a real archaeologist digs friggin' holes with, you know, trowels. But this is epigraphy we're talking about, the study of ancient writing. Yet that is so heavily tied into how we see, especially I think at the pop level, our archaeology and what people think we do. And so I wanted to explore that a little. But first off, I do want to say this is not my primary training. I would not be considered an epigrapher, although I can follow along and produce. I've gotten even a few jobs like writing things in hieroglyphs, probably poorly. And when I worked on this bottle, my co-author, Mark Zender, from Tulane University on this article, he is an epigrapher. He's a very well-known one. And he also does a lot of art history and iconography, the study of complex imagery and symbols. And he wrote back, this is really good for a non-epigrapher. And my first immediate reaction was like, are you serious? And then I started reading. And he's like, yeah, no, you got the verb right in this. But it's the 12th king. It's not the 14th king. It's Kak-Uti-Wit-Kawil, not Kak-Hopla-Chang-Kawil. And this whole back part here, it's not referring to this, it's referring to this. And I'm like, all right, that's actually eminently fair. Thank you. But I had at least been able to sort of figure out what we were looking at, kind of realize its significance, and we're not going to get into that because that's not what this show is about. But I wanted to use that as a preface to sort of, you know, get to this point that first of all, we've done recently a few episodes on pop culture. And if you look at any pop culture image of the archaeologist, half the time, they're sitting there reading things on a wall. They're reading off of a stone wall with strange carved figures that only they can understand and that often have importance, either mystical or science fictional or something.
But that's exactly true with we were talking about Indiana Jones, that he's got that paper that's in Maya and it helps him find something in South America. But he's reading it and nobody else can.
In the first one, there's actually hieroglyphs are also really important as well. So no, it's a major part of the image. And then not only that, never minding fiction, look at the history of how people consume archaeology, what interests them. It's a big deal. And when my students take Lost Cities and Ancient Civilizations, our intro course to archaeology, to world prehistory, really, one of the exercises they love the best is when I take a bunch of names in, and I don't do Egyptian hieroglyphs in any professional way. I play around like a minor little hobbyist at best. But I take a bunch of famous names like Akhenaten and Tutankhamun and Imhotep and all of these, and I put them on the board, and I basically say, these are their names. These are their names in ancient Egyptian. These are their names transliterated into modern English equivalent and even a translation. Figure out what the individual glyphs are. You've got 20 minutes. I'm basically having them do what Champollion did with the Rosetta Stone. They love that exercise more than any other one we do. Hmm. More than handling actual artifacts, more than a whole bunch of other things we do. That they love that one. Also, I think there's the group effort. There's just we have kids. A lot of them are like, oh, I remember writing my name in Egyptian when I was in fifth grade. There is just something inherently cool. And I wanted to talk about where that idea sort of came from. And frankly, the word hieroglyph. I mean, these are just writing systems. Like these are things that record ancient writing, ancient language. The thing is, the stuff that we talk about a lot on this show, what y'all call the fringe, and I sometimes call apparently the alternative media now, they, on the one hand, love hieroglyphs. And on the other hand, they can't stand them. Because you're like, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. It actually makes a lot of sense. If you look at the history of decipherment, there is a repeated history of people claiming they understand ancient writings, and especially what are called hieroglyphs in various places. We'll talk about that history a little. But not really able to understand it. And then once these things actually can be read, all of a sudden they lose their mysticism, and they often lose a lot of value, and often actually mark the difference between a more mystical bent and often the origins of alternative fringe, pseudo-archaeology, whatever, and professional scientific archaeology in a given region or on a given culture.
Well, there's power in the ability to translate correctly or incorrectly some written text. And so if you've got professionals who actually are accurately and correctly translating something, they remove the power from these folks who have a more mystical bent, because now they don't have that key to explaining this ancient culture. Somebody else does.
Right. But on the other hand, a lot of the people who have kind of embargoed that power in the past have been professionals. Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the things that makes a good translation, I don't mean of a specific object, although that's true there too, but like a good decipherment, actually. So a translation of an object, translation of a text versus the decipherment of a system. The hallmark of an actual decipherment is anybody can do it. It's kind of like a scientific experiment. There should be no magic to it. Like once you're told the rules, you should be able to do this. If you can roughly understand the language, even if you can understand some of the system of it, once you're taught the basics of how the system works, you should be able to, in essence, follow along. And in fact, that's how we test decipherments. This is why I think it is often, it takes away from people wanting to mystify these things, because it actually becomes extremely transparent. But the word alone, the word hieroglyph, I think is sort of at the basis of the whole problem. That is an old Greek word, obviously. It means sacred signs. And it goes back to the Greeks absolutely being in love with their idea of Egyptian writing from the ancient. Mm-hmm. Basically, so there are five places, this gets complicated, but there are basically five places around the world where writing emerges independently. Basically going east to west, you have northern China. You have the Indus Valley, even though it may have been somewhat inspired by the rise of cuneiform, it's not related as far as we can tell. We can't read it. Some people say they can read it. We may be able to read some parts of it. It has not been fully deciphered by most accounts. There are people who disagree with that, but this is one of these things. You'll see people who say, oh, well, I can read all of this. Oh, really? Well, yeah.
Are there academics that disagree yes. with being able to read cuneiform?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean...
Well, not cuneiform. Not cuneiform. Indus Valley script.
There's at least one monograph whose title I can't remember, in which it is this valiant attempt to, as accurate as possible, decipher Indus Valley script. But I think also one of the problems is there's not a ton of artifacts with that writing on.
No, that's not the problem. There are quite a few of them. The texts they're all little stamp seals. The texts are all really short. So one of the ones we're going to talk, a couple of the ones we're going to talk about, they were broken statistically, at least to some degree. If you have tiny little fragments that might not even necessarily be full sentences, and you don't know if they are or not, you can't do anything with structure. And since we also don't know for certain what the language is, and that's the problem there, of course, is also there's controversy because of modern day identities and religious and ethnic concerns over, well, who is the Indus? Is it the basis of this religion, or is it not? Basis of this language group, or is it not? Does this language group come in, or does it not? And I'm not going to get into that. There, you have Chinese with oracle bones. You have the Indus. You have cuneiform, which, while it's invented by, and this gets also complicated, it's generally considered to be invented by people who speak the now dead Sumerian language, but it's used by multiple language groups after that. You have Egyptian hieroglyphs. You've got the linear systems of the Aegean. Linear A and B, and they get complicated as to exactly how independent they are, although they probably are to some degree. And then you have Maya and Olmec and Zapotec, and again, how independent they are from each other also gets complicated. And so these are what are often considered like the...
Now, I was gonna say, a quick question before we go to break. Are all of those considered hieroglyphic languages, written languages, or which ones specifically are... identified as, I guess, true hieroglyphs? Or am I asking a really complicated question?
Well, see, that gets to the whole point. I mean, well, no, you're asking the question I'm trying to lead up to.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, I mean, what the hell does hieroglyph mean? It means sacred sign. This is the Greek word for the Egyptians, because they thought, and this, of course, powers much of sort of occult ideas about archaeology and especially about Egypt. They thought that this writing held super mystical, symbolic, although who's they? Because are we talking about the Greeks in, say, 300 BCE? Are we talking about the Greeks and the Romans of 200 CE? It's a 500-year difference, and the ideas about hieroglyphs had changed. But we'll pick up that thread after, because it does get complicated, but that's one of the things I'm leading up to.
Gotcha.
But those are all basically pristine systems. There are other writing systems. I mean, there's runes and there's numerous other systems where you can see at least some relationship to existing systems. I mean, for example, Japanese borrows characters. It's not the same language as Chinese. It's not the same structure as Chinese, but clearly there is a relationship between the character systems. And there are others like that as well. You know, Greek inspires, Roman inspires, and so on. Those are where this happens independently. And these are often places where you have a lot of ideas about mysticism. I mean, I think we're going to talk a bit about 2012 here, potentially, depending on how far we get, and ancient Egyptian writings and mysticism. The funny thing is that, and we've talked about in the past how there, you know, Ken, you were complaining on our episode about Gungiwamp about so-called linguists, people making all kinds of sort of Barry Fell style connections.
Right, yeah.
And others, but that often gets very far away from what we're actually talking about, epigraphers, who can be very persnickety with very complicated subjects. And I will just tell you this, my students love Egyptian hieroglyphs, at least in their sort of classical full hieroglyphic on the stone walls, on the sacred objects form. They're very discreet. Oh, look, it's a foot. Oh, look, it's a snake. Right. It's two reeds. They hate Maya sometimes because the way Maya is incredibly convoluted, and when it's put on the paper, it's this black on white. But I can see Maya really easily. Maybe I've just been trained at it. Maybe I've looked at it enough. like a cuneiform, and I'm just like, I have no idea what I'm looking at. It looks like you dropped 1,000 grains of rice, and they're sitting at random angles, which is, I'm sure, how some of my students look at Maya. But to answer your question after the break, I think, one, there's that kind of form thing, but it's also, what do people think about writing? Because that, then, of course, that gets back to other issues as well. So let's answer that when we come back.
Kim Bidulf explores the books set in our prehistoric past on Prehistories, an innovative and creative show. Kim investigates the archaeology and anthropology behind your favorite stories by bringing on guests that are experts in the field and that can speak to the actual story behind the story. Check out the show at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/prehistories. Now let's get back to the show.
We are back, and we are still talking about hieroglyphics, and Ken, you had an important thing.
Well, I don't know how important it is, but Jeff, you were talking about how your students are kind of enamored of Egyptian hieroglyphs, and the Maya, maybe not so much, but they're really cool, but no, cuneiform doesn't, like, float anybody's boat. You know, everybody I know who's ever gone to Egypt has come back with those dopey little unks with their names written in Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Yeah, the little cartouches, yeah.
Yeah, and there was, I don't know if it still exists, but there was a website for years in which you could get your name in Maya hieroglyphs. And I had an app on my phone that where you could punch in your birthday, and it would give you your birthday in Maya, yeah. In Maya
hieroglyphs. Oh, yeah, I mean,
but
there are...
You don't see that for cuneiform. I don't see anybody running around with cuneiform on their t-shirts.
First off, there are some. I've seen some things that actually do work that way a little.
Uh-huh.
Secondly, I don't know the name of this guy. I don't want to give a shout out, so I'll just say Dave Anderson, a repeat guest on our show, a friend of his actually will do customized. He will make customized cuneiform tablets for you.
I've seen a little video of it. He's amazing.
Yeah.
With this one little stick of wood, he's making all of these images.
Yeah, and he's turning it around, and that is actually an important part of a – because you'll see that a lot of – we actually have a few cuneiform – I have printouts of – like 3D prints of cuneiform tablets, but we also have a few real ones in our library here. They called me a few years ago. It's like, hey, could you come look at some things? This seems to happen a lot with me. But they have a couple of actual cuneiform tablets, and I'm like, please stop touching those. But and they did. But no, I had some students work on those and on a piece of Egyptian hieroglyphs we have. A lot of them are lozenge shaped. They have writing on multiple sides, and some of them are circular. This act of turning and writing that way, which is something we don't do with paper and pen, and we don't do with typewriters or computers. We go down. We go across and down, across and down, across and down. Is actually an important part of writing in cuneiform, which is probably why it also looks very confusing, because it's not necessarily some one angle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are multiple sites online where you can just plug in a date, and you'll get out the various versions of Mesoamerican calendars. Mm-hmm. I'm certain there must be one on a site that's very useful for Mesoamerican writing, FAMSI.org. The Foundation for the Advancement of Mesoamerican Studies Incorporated. It's FAMSI.org, the Foundation for the Advancement of Mesoamerican Studies Incorporated, FAMSI. It is a very useful website with tons and tons of dictionaries, tutorials, workbooks, glyph dictionaries, all kinds of things. They have one, I don't know if it still works because it's an older tech, where it'll actually read the words out in Maya. It'll be like, Baham, like stuff like that. So if you don't know Maya, you can hear what it sounds like. So they have a lot of cool stuff there. They also have the fantastic Justin Care rollout database of rolled out cylinder vessels, where you have these beautiful artworks and glyphs painted around a cylinder that people drank chocolate out of in, say, 700 CE in Guatemala. So you can look at it as a flat panel. And those are all there as well.
Just in case people out there are thinking, well, but Maya, that's like a dead language. It certainly isn't.
Oh, God, no. In fact, first of all, there are millions and millions of indigenous Maya speakers today in multiple countries. And in fact, there are there are classes and courses to revive the use of hieroglyphs as part of Maya society. And there are indigenous newspapers that are printed in Guatemala, and I think in Mexico, but I know in Guatemala, where the whole thing or most of it is in alphabetic script, but in the Maya language. So in Cachiquel, but in, you know,
I see. Right. Yeah,
but parts of it are in hieroglyphs.
That's cool, though.
Parts of it are like like headers on newspapers and stuff. And it is not a system that survived. It did go, just like Egyptian, go extinct in terms of use, and then was revived by scholars
And just in case our listeners don't know, could you tell us, there are all these Maya, the screenfold, the bark books. Yeah. What happened to most of those?
Right. There are three or four, and whether there are three or four gets really controversial, books from before the Spaniards that are Maya and have Maya hieroglyphs. The Dresden, the Madrid, and the Paris Codex, and then the Grolier Codex, which some people are like, this is absolutely legitimate, and others are not. And they're named for places they were shown or found. The rest were, I mean, some have been probably found archaeologically, but they are a mess, and they cannot be pulled apart because they're in tropics, right. And they're made of bark and plaster, and to pull them apart would destroy them, and that has happened. People have destroyed them. But there were a ton that were destroyed, hundreds or thousands, at the time of the conquest. Most specifically, there were multiple times it happened, but there was a massive auto-da-fe in Yucatan, overseen by Bishop Diego de Landa, the Archbishop of Yucatan in the later 16th century. And now we'll come back to his story, because he's really important for the Maya decipherment. But yeah, the Greeks called hieroglyphs, Egyptian hieroglyphs, sacred signs. That's what hieroglyph means. They very much thought that the Egyptians were the most ancient civilization in the world, and then that's where like wisdom was stored. And you guys have talked about that with Atlantis, which is why when Plato makes up Atlantis, he's like, well, where am I going to get super ancient wisdom? Some guy told me who went to Egypt and learned it from the ancient Egyptian, you know, masters. So you have that then percolate into Hellenistic culture and Roman culture, Greek, you know, Greco-Roman culture. And over the 500-600 years that hieroglyphs were still somewhat used in Egypt, but were going out of fashion, and Greek writing was becoming the lingua franca, they become increasingly seen by Greek sources. And there are Greek sources at least have some idea of what they're doing, because Egyptians tell them. But they increasingly become mystical and symbolic. And this then transfers into the Abrahamic ideas, Christian and Muslim ideas of ancient hieroglyphs, and into European ideas of ancient hieroglyphs as being ancient and symbolic. And eventually, by the Middle Ages, and really by the Renaissance, because in the Middle Ages, they don't know that much about hieroglyphs, but in the Renaissance, Europeans start to become really obsessed with hieroglyphs again. But they think that they are a sort of almost pre-linguistic or even pre-linguistic form of communication, something that maybe you could use to communicate with just like language, but actually encodes much more information, much more symbolic and magical information. Mm-hmm. And this is actually sort of the idea of hieroglyphs that inspires pop culture today and inspires a lot of alternative archaeology ideas. You know, this notion that hieroglyphs or writing, ancient writings, and only certain ancient writings have deep hidden meanings that only the initiates can understand.
Do you think it's because these are pictures? We can kind of recognize these individual images. That's a hawk. That's an obelisk. And that somehow that's how this mysterious knowledge is being encoded?
That is definitely part. Well, also, I think cuneiform largely gets forgotten to a large degree. While there are monuments with it, it largely gets forgotten, whereas Egyptian survives. And I think those pictures are part of it. I definitely think so. Mm-hmm. Although one thing I want to say straight off, while some things in whether it's Maya or Egyptian or other systems that look like pictures may have some relationship to the things that they're pictures of, and some do, most of the time they don't. Most of the time, so the most famous example is, or one that's often used to teach Maya, is Pakal. It means shield, and it's you would write it in English as P-A-K-A-L, Pakal. And you can write that as a shield. You can draw a shield. And you can also write it with symbols that have nothing to do with a shield, including one that's a net. What's a net have to do with it? Nothing. What's a fish, which is the cosi, have to do with it? Nothing. You can just write these things out. But one of the words for fish is ka. Like, no, there's a relationship to it being a fish, but it's not being used for anything involving a fish here. So it's not picture writing. And this is one of these kind of these common ideas. But it is, yeah. So these both Maya and Egyptian both have phonetic elements, and then they both have morphemic or logographic elements where
right.
a symbol means a concept or a word. Mm-hmm. And even technically alphabetic systems. I mean, so for example, how many symbols does the English language, the English alphabet have? How many symbols? It's a grammar school quiz.
The current one?
Yeah. How many symbols?
What is that, 26?
26.
26 letters. What's a question mark?
Right, that's not a letter.
What's an
a
exclamation?
Symbol?
What's an exclamation point?
Right.
What's a period?
Those are punctuation marks. But those are punctuation marks.
But right, those so are part of the writing still. System. They are part
right.
of the writing system.
Right, right.
Those, so for example, if I talked about hieroglyphics, that's entirely written out phonetically. One of those on there involves a plural. Now, if I put, for example, Jeb's hieroglyphics book. Jeb's is my name written out with three phonetic letters, and then there's an apostrophe and an S. Now you're saying Jeb's, but you're also with that apostrophe, whether you have it or not, determines are we talking about Jeb is doing a thing or it's Jeb's book. So that's a symbol that is not, there are more than 26 even in the alphabetic system. That's
sure,
what I
mean. Sure.
So no system is purely phonetic. It's a spectrum, although alphabetic systems are very, very phonetic. Whereas traditional Chinese has a massive phonetic component, but it's largely a morphemic system. So hieroglyphs are somewhere in the spectrum. But Egyptian, it gets known to the Renaissance folks, and they very much think it's symbolic, and they start to become fascinated by it. And by sort of luck, not terribly long after they start to become fascinated by Egyptian, to the point where they're making fake obelisks in Paris and writing out translations that are part of alchemy, which has not much to do with anything. Also, one other thing, a number of scholars, well, it just doesn't. I mean, they're making it up.
Right.
Athenaeus Kircher, one of the big scholars of the Renaissance on this, mm-hmm. he actually he and others made up their own hieroglyphic systems. Like openly, like, oh, this is my special hieroglyphic system. Meaning, like, so they were almost looking at them as like ciphers,
mm-hmm.
code-breaking right. systems. And there's a long history of thinking of them that way. One other thing, a lot of people, and Jason Colavito has talked about this a bit. He's been kind of piecing this together. He and others have suggested that one reason they may also have this meaning, maybe Egyptian, is so there's the whole Hermetic thing. A lot of later mysticism, the Hermetic magical tradition, is based on a mix of Greek and Egyptian ideas and a whole bunch of other stuff being thrown in from the Hellenistic period. And some of the folks who were doing that as the Roman Empire began to crumble may well have been kind of hanging out and hiding out and even living like hermits and ascetics in ancient temples. So that may also be part of where this whole why are these special comes from, because mm-hmm. these sort of wizards, if you want to think about them, are hanging out in these temples. All right. But it doesn't hurt the whole thing that around the time in the Renaissance that Europeans are starting to get really excited about Egyptian hieroglyphs as this sort of ancient key to the past, even possibly even the pre-Tower of Babel past, they run into Mexico. Almost immediately when Europeans start seeing in the 16th century Mesoamerican writing systems, they think of them as being hieroglyphs and that they must be related to Egyptian. Because they can see that they're kind of like pictures and they don't understand it. So they're like, right. this must be somewhat similar. And then this kind of shocked me when I found this out. There was very little knowledge of Chinese writing in Western Europe also until the 16th century. So basically within 200 years of Egyptian or Europeans really getting interested in Egyptian again, they suddenly run into Chinese and Maya and Mexican writing almost simultaneously. So this idea emerges, and you can sort of see hints of later evolutionary thought, like cultural evolutionary, not biological evolutionary, of, oh, these must all be much more ancient forms of writing, and they must be closer to creation, and they must therefore have more mystical meaning mm-hmm. and significance. And so the old Greek concept gets sort of reborn in the Renaissance, and you have the origin of this kind of mystical concept. And this is largely the sort of image that we see of the hieroglyph in, even today, In Ancient Aliens and in all kinds of Atlantean as sort of a mystical ancient text that is not just writing but has deeper significance and deeper mystical secrets. This starts to fall out before decipherment. By the 18th century, European scholars start to think that Egyptian is probably a writing system and not a lot more mystical. And even before Champollion and the Rosetta Stone in the early 19th century, you already start to have the split between the massive infusion of Egyptian hieroglyphs and imagery into stuff like Freemasonry and secret societies and all of that, and also artworks and all that, and the beginnings of scientific and professional scholarly Egyptology. Now, of course, once Champollion and others come along and for the first time crack a dead language or a dead writing system of hieroglyphs in the 1820s, then it irrevocably splits. So even though we can see, and we deal all the time, and what we talk about on this show, with the sort of ancient sacred and erroneous to some degree, although the full body hieroglyphs in Egypt, for example, were largely meant for sort of kingly, sacred, magical type things. Not entirely, but that was sort of the thing. You had other systems, hieratic and then demotic, which were sort of more shorthandy or scripty versions as time went. But the classical original versions, that they sort of did originate to some degree, not entirely. They also had practical uses in a mystical bent. And you sort of see the same thing with Maya. But you have, by the beginnings of the 19th century, this split. And I think when we come back from break, I'd like to talk a little bit more about Maya and the decipherment of Maya and how you can sort of see, and we've talked about this a touch with the Mu stones, but I want to talk about it in a bit more detail and a bit more scope, sort of see the continuing origins on the one hand of a lot of sort of mysticism about the classic Maya, and on the other hand, the development of what we now know about ancient Maya society.
Hosted by archaeologist Emily Long, Trowel Tales is an archaeology podcast with stories told by archaeologists about the crazy world of archaeology. Emily weaves a tale of wonder and excitement with her intriguing questions and imaginative editing skills. Check out Trowel Tales today at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Trowel Tales. Now let's get back to the show.
Everyone, and we are back, and we are still talking hieroglyphs. And Ken, you had a question that you wanted to pose to Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, on occasion, I have heard people describe the Maya hieroglyphic system as fundamentally as being a rebus. And, you know, rebus is where you have these pictures that you add together to form words. There used to be a game show on TV called Concentration, you had to pick these things, and you would, you know, so the if you saw a sheep, for example, and said, "Oh, that's a female sheep, that's a ewe," but ewe has another word meaning you, the pronoun, and if you added it all together, you could solve it. And I've heard Maya as well. It's kind of like a rebus. You look at these images and you say the images out loud in the Maya language. But when you're done saying them, you get the true message.
A classic example. Like if you were talking about a religious belief in a rebus system, you could draw a picture of a bee and draw a picture of a leaf, and you get a belief. No, that is, I hesitate to say what I'm about to say, but I think it's accurate. Generally, in most really old writing systems, like pre-alphabetic, non-alphabetic systems I can think of, there are elements of rebus in their development. This is true of Egyptian. This is true of cuneiform. This is true of Chinese oracle bones. I don't know if we can say that for linear systems. And it's true of Maya in the sense that, like, oh, there's a fish here. And that could refer, if you're writing about a fish, which is ka, but that's rarely done. Instead, usually if you see that little fish, that is the sound ka, like in pakal. Or actually my favorite, cacao. For chocolate, it's the cacao, or, you know, cocoa is probably an Olmec word, and the Maya wrote it out as cacawa, you know, cacao. No, Maya does not work that way in the way we know it. You can see somewhere in its development, but that's a thing people do in lots of places. But no, it is a logo, it is a morphosyllabic system where you've got morphemes for words and concepts, and you have syllables, not individual sounds like p or b or but pa or pay or po or ba or bay or bo. So it has a system like that, which Egyptian, that gets complicated, but a system somewhat like that is going to have more symbols, probably a several hundred, rather than if it was purely syllabic, you'd have several dozen. An alphabetic system has usually about 30, like we talked about. Mm-hmm. And Chinese has well over 1,000. I think it's may have several thousand. I'm not an expert on that, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, how Maya works, and I might talk about some other examples like this, how Maya works and how we got to knowing how it works illustrates some really interesting things. So today, the vast majority of Maya writing can be read. The vast, vast majority. There are still some glyphs we don't entirely understand. People talked about it being like 80 to 90% of them in the 1990s, and it is virtually all of them today. There are still texts that are sometimes difficult, and that's true even in other systems, although some are better known than others. But for the most part, we can read it. But what that is and how that came to be. So the earliest clue we got to all of this, we mentioned Diego de Landa. He destroyed all kinds of Maya books, Maya religious objects, etc., Maya cultural objects. But in his sort of legal defense, his Relación de las Cosas de Yucatán, he wrote down an alphabet. And he had a Maya noble who was literate translate this alphabet. Of course, the problem is Maya doesn't have an alphabet. It's a syllabic. Mm-hmm. And so this led to a lot of confusion. His book, a copy of his book, gets rediscovered in archives. We talked about this on our Mu episode because it was by Brasser de Bourbourg, who believed in Atlantis, and he believed Maya hieroglyphs had that ancient sort of hidden message about Atlantis, which comes from that Renaissance sort of idea, which even comes from some of the Greeks, of hieroglyphs, of they have to have something more going on than just words or just grammar. So when it is discovered and rediscovered in archives in the 19th century, it's useless. I mean, it's not useless, but nobody was able to properly use it. They kept trying. Different people kept trying to plug it in as an alphabet and got nowhere. They just were not. They just didn't work. The first European depictions of Maya hieroglyphs are hard to track down. We start to have depictions of them in situ in ancient sites, like on walls, in the early 19th century. You start to have accurate ones sometime in the 19th century. Now, we mentioned the codices, and they were named for Dresden, Madrid, and Paris. Well, this is where they were found in archives. They were probably brought back by Spanish conquistadors, possibly Cortez, or sent back by Cortez. That kickstarts that, plus the discovery of de Landa. The de Landa Relación, while the syllabic thing, which I've given away what it really was, the syllabic thing is not undeciphered, is not realized until the middle of the 20th century. He also talked about the number system, the vigesimal 20 number system. Mm-hmm. That does quickly start to get used. And by 1905, actually, the guy who – there's multiple calendars. I don't know if we're going to talk about 2012 today. We may actually do a whole episode on 2012. But in the late 19th century, they start to piece together the three multiple Mesoamerican calendars. There's the 260-day calendar, which is 13 numbers times 20 day names. Mesoamerican numbers are vigesimal. They're written in 20, not in tens. Roman numerals are a mess. But in India and in Mesoamerica, people invented the zero, basically placeholders. So we talk about a decimal system. We talk about decimals. You would talk about vigesimals in Mesoamerica. But otherwise, it's a conceptually similar system. They figure that out. They figure out the days of the calendar, because it still was in operation, still is in operation in parts, uninterrupted. But they figure all these things out, and scholars start to go through the codices, these ancient books, and they start to realize some of the systems. They start to get a feel for how the 260-day works, how the 365-day calendar, which is 18 months of 20 days plus an additional period of 5 days, works. And by 1905, they figure out the long count, which is the one behind the whole 2012 business. I actually like a little historical note. If you look at that today, the most famous correlation of that to the Gregorian calendar is the Goodman-Martinez-Thompson system, And the first Goodman there is John Goodman. He's not the actor, of course.
I was going
to say. He was a newspaper man. He was a newspaper publisher, and he actually gave Mark Twain his first job. So there's that. I don't know why. I just find that a little. But he was an ex. Yeah, he was an expat in Panama, and he did this as his hobby, and he figures it out by 1905. So by the early 20th century, we can basically correlate, although there's the Spinden correlation, the exact correlation was off for a while. But either way, we basically understand calendars. And then a thing happens, and this is something we see. We see this with Minoan, with the linear scripts as well. You see powerful figures, powerful personalities emerge in archaeology that become the best people at not being able to read a thing. I cannot read this better than anyone else. And by that, I mean they know the system inside out as best as it's understood. They have insights that nobody else does, but they can't really read it. This puts you in a very interesting position. On the one hand, you can kind of, I don't want to say make it up, but you can sort of bend things. Your biases can have a lot of power because there's no check on them. Because nobody else can check what you're saying. But on the other hand, you're the world authority. And this sort of happens with Arthur Evans, and it's no accident. And the whole story, we should get somebody on about the Minoan, because I'm not an expert, and I know it a little. But the decipherment of Linear B has multiple players, and it all happens after Arthur Evans dies, because he was hoarding all the Linear B texts that he had dug up. He wasn't letting anybody else play with them. Not soon after they all get out, Linear B is broken within a few years statistically, and it's figured out to be Greek. Yeah. Maya was not hoarded. I mean, everybody had access, or a lot of people had access to these things. But it fell under the sway of a couple of really sort of charismatic figures. And we've talked about Sylvanus Griswold Morley a little before. He was also a major spy for the Office of Naval Intelligence in the United States and other things. He was one of the heads of early Maya archaeology. But the guy who really puts his stamp on everything is Thompson. I mentioned the Goodman-Martinez-Thompson correlation. J. Eric Thompson, Sir J. Eric Thompson, eventually. He's one of these archaeologists that gets a sir, both because of his class as well as his doings. Even by the 1910s, but certainly by the 1930s, a sort of dogma had set in that, one, ancient Maya was not phonetic, that it was probably a morpho system, like a morphemic system with a lot of religious and mystical importance. Not mystical like, oh, this does things, but like that is religious in nature,
okay,
which is just like the Renaissance and Greek ideas of hieroglyphs. Two, that it was heavily involved with mathematics and astronomy, which is, of course, like the old lamppost problem. You know, the guy is out in the street looking for – the drunk guy looking for his keys. It's like, oh, let me help him. It's like, where'd you lose them? Well, I lost them over there, but the light's better here. They understood math. They understood the calendar. And over time, it got to the point where they're like, that must be what these are all about, the parts we understand, because of course it is. To the point where Sylvanus Griswold Morley, he was one of the major people recording Maya hieroglyphic monuments that were being found. He was not recording the non-calendric parts. He was only recording the calendar parts.
So they had a bias there in their data.
A massive bias. Which,
but it's also
thinking.
It's also where the stereotype of the Maya as these noble, mystical astronomer priests.
Right.
And there's nothing about war and nothing about politics or economics. Yeah. It's all about them sitting cross-legged and looking up at the heavens.
And so that was the next big precept. So they were not phonetic. They were heavily about astronomy. They were heavily about religion and mysticism, which meant that all of these centers of these cities weren't really cities. This also was being biased by ideas about anthropology at the time, like what was going on in the Highland Maya area. That these were sort of
ceremonial
centers. And then, as you said, that they were not about history, and they were certainly not about war. And so this really deep set and still existing in some quarters idea that the Maya were philosopher kings, and not even really kings. They were philosopher priests, astronomers, and never mind that there's images of bloody battle, never mind images of tribute, never mind images of feasting and partying and getting alcohol up your ass with an enema and all these sorts of things. Never minding beautiful pictures of birds and never minding all this stuff. It's like, no, they must be astronomer priests. And Thompson, there's been a lot of sort of psychoanalyzing of Thompson where people believe that, and in his academic work, this doesn't come across as well, but he also wrote popular works where he very clearly fell in love with this idea. And you can sort of see, one, his distaste for war after World War I. And two, his concern about peasant rebellions after the Russian Revolution and fears of communist uprising in the West. You can sort of see this. He was seeing himself and sort of being like, an, you know, the sort of Church of England, Anglican. That's how he kind of saw the Maya. That's how he kind of saw these Maya priests.
Right.
So after World War II in the 1950s, you start to see things change. It comes from multiple quarters. The first one is interesting. It doesn't entirely challenge us, but it really would in many ways. There's actually there's a whole long history of sort of hobbyists being involved, amateurs, which is also one of these things we've talked about in the past, involved in Maya hieroglyphs, in Maya epigraphy. Heinrich Berlin, he's of German origin. He'd been living in Mexico. He was a grocer. He figured out in 1958 and published, there was these things he called emblem glyphs that he noticed had geographic distributions. He didn't know if they were the names of cities or if they were the names of ruling dynasties, but he figured they had something to do with these cities and politics. That was actually a very astute observation because the answer is all of the above. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the names of cities, they are the names of dynasties, but in many times the names of those dynasties come from the actual names of those cities, but not always. And that's really interesting. So that started to suggest, maybe there is room for a little bit of history. 2 years later, in 1960, Tatiana Proskoryakov, her family emigrated from Russia, and then the Russian Revolution emerged, and then they sort of stayed. They were sort of white Russians in that sense, politically. She became an expert in hieroglyphs. She started to figure out structure. She started to find things that she believed, and correctly, she couldn't read them linguistically, but she figured out structurally they had to mean birth. They had to mean ascension to power. And she started to use this to find individuals. Like, oh, look, there are clusters of monuments at the city of Piedras Negras that have 60, 70 years, one cluster of monuments, and the early glyph and the later glyph. It's more complicated than that. But basically started to find kings. She couldn't say their names, but she could identify their names structurally. She started to find glyphs for war. She couldn't read what they could what they were, but she could sort of figure out, well, this is happening, sort of, kind of, and it's in this part. It must be something like this. So she was doing this structurally. Thompson was kind of okay with this. He initially was he was also a colleague of hers. He was initially unhappy, but then came over to it. But something had happened a few years earlier he wanted no part of, and this was Yuri Norozov. Or I've also heard of Konorosov. I always thought it was Norozov. I could be wrong. A Russian Soviet scholar. He went back, looked at Delanda, and realized that the Delanda catalog or the Delanda alphabet was no alphabet. It was syllabic. He started breaking it up, and he realized that that noble had been, and I've talked about this a little on the show before, had been spelling out the letters Ache or Se, not H or K, but the whole letters. Once he realized that, he could sort of reconfigure this quote unquote alphabet into a syllabary, and it worked. Now, he had some errors, but Thompson hated it. One, he didn't trust him because he was a Soviet. There was sort of a history at that time of like super Soviet science does a thing, and it wasn't always accurate for propaganda purposes.
Right.
But in this case, it was real. In this case, it was real. And as I said, Thompson was not a fan of communism. Also, people like Brasseur, who was nuts on Atlantis, and people like Benjamin Whorf, who was a theosophist, had been down the phonetic road and failed. So he was like, oh, it just means one more case of crazy. But it wasn't. Younger scholars in the 1960s, like Michael Coe and David Kelly, they started picking up on this and going forward. And this kind of broke open in the 70s. 1973 is often the year everybody points at when you have Peter Matthews, Linda Sheely, and others at Palenque realizing that they could read for the first time the names of kings. And within a couple of days, they had broken open basically the bare bones of dynastic history. Now, things had progressed dramatically. And I don't want to get into all the sort of classic Maya history. That'd be its own whole show. It'd be fascinating. Maybe we'll do that in the future, how that's changed. But basically, you had that same kind of fast, rapid professionalization. We went from the 1950s not being able to understand a damn thing except for math to the 1960s, understanding there was history, but we could barely understand any of it, to the 1970s with Joyce Marcus and others beginning to plot out using emblem glyphs vague structures of Maya political structure. And then all of a sudden in the 1970s, this dramatic breakthrough of the phonetics. This starts to snowball. In the 80s, all of a sudden, these discoveries are coming. By 1990, the first serious historical treatment. And now we're reading like Maya religious texts that are supposed to be secret, magical doings and spirits, possibly things we might call witchcraft, deep political structure, florid discussions of massacres, all these sorts of things. And as that has happened, have people in, say, the History Channel world, in the fringe world, in the world of bullshit, have they liked any of this?
No.
Oh, hell no. Right, no, right. No. They're still basically regurgitating the 19th century. They will use the names. They will cherry pick things,
But they always fall back on the, what does it look like? Well, it looks to me like, and then you get the misinterpretation. Like, it's
sometimes, no, actually what they do is they love the number stuff because that's old. It's from the Victorian period and it allows for millions of years and all. And again, we'll probably do a 2012 show, right. But while they don't necessarily in many cases, some actually do deny the decipherment, a lot don't, but they don't use any of its consequences that these are political players, that they're fighting for this. And it's only, they still talk about all the stuff they still talk about, even though it's not in the writing. A few of them do actually try to misinterpret. Again, we'll talk about the 2012. That's probably the biggest example of some of it. But a lot of the times it becomes a parallel universe. And David Webster has talked about this in the book where this podcast gets its show. David Webster had a chapter in that book that talks about Mayanism. So when you hear people talk about – scholars talk about Mayanism, it's the same way that people talk about Egyptomania. It's the same sort of idea of this kind of alternative occult sort of concept of the Maya. And you see this all the time. And they basically – they don't entirely ignore it. They're kind of excited, but they don't follow any of it to its real sort of consequences.
But I think the most interesting thing here is that, I mean, here we've got a situation in which largely because of the decipherment, we have historical characters now. They're not these anonymous mystical priests, historical characters with names. We know what they were doing. We know about that. We know fire is born, and we know that he invaded the Maya territory from Tenochtitlan, and we know these events, and people don't want that. They want something else, something other than the actual history of the Maya told by the Maya.
Well,
that's sad.
Well, you see, some take parts of it. Like, it's interesting, and it's just like Egyptian. Like, there are parts of ancient Egyptian that all of a sudden get heavily grabbed by people in sort of the magical and occult sphere and the alternative archaeology. And then there's other parts they don't really like to talk about. So it's like everything else. They'll take some parts, ignore other parts, but it is usually that decipherment. And it's the same thing to a lesser extent with Linear B. Once Linear B is read, and once all of a sudden it gets kind of brought down, there was this whole mythology of Minoans as the first Europeans and da da da. And it turns out that basically Linear B is just writing out like accounting and war. And it was used for other things, but it's basically one more palace society on the edge of the Eastern Mediterranean palace societies. And a lot of the sort of fantasies that had been imposed on this utopia just kind of fell flat. And that's the same thing with Egypt. It's the same thing with Maya. So the presence of writing kind of symbolizes the idea of civilization. And if it's super ancient writing, which isn't around anymore, it even more makes it ancient, secret, lost, mystical knowledge of lost civilization. So that builds this up and makes it hyper attractive to all kinds of esoteric thought. And then when you decipher it, and it's like, and then they invaded Soconusco to get chocolate. All of a sudden,
which was important at the time.
Yes.
To be
fair. Yeah. No.
To be fair.
Well, sugar is important now.
That's true.
People live and die on sugar. It is the decipherment opens up whole new vistas. It opens up all kinds of new knowledge, but because it's not the knowledge that had been built up, and again, these are really fantasies that are imposed from outside, it's often not as welcome as one would hope.
Well, I mean, what they're doing is rejecting the translations as, well, that's mundane. That's not special. We want something decidedly different.
Go ahead.
I'm just saying, which robs from the Maya their history. Because we don't want their history. We want to impose some completely different story or different agenda on these people.
Right. You will see exactly. They wanna put this study. You will see some of them say, well, yeah, they just focus on this mundane stuff, but then there's deeper secrets. There are still deeper secrets appearing. You'll see that. You'll see that idea. And then you also will get people who will say, oh no, I actually understand all of this. And it gets really complicated. You will find all kinds. Just imagine any other sort of fringy type scene and all the people that pretend to do this, that, and the other. And it's there in spades. It really is. The relationship between the professional archaeologists, and here's the other thing, and this is kind of, I think, some of the things that I think has come across a little, when these decipherments happen, it often actually also drives a wedge between the professional archaeologists and the professional epigraphers. There's not always 100% love. While they don't disagree necessarily, there may be like a, well, you only care about royals, and well, you only care about potsherds, and then it gets all bitey and all sorts of things.
Right. But potsherds can be so much fun.
Both can be so much fun.
But that's, I mean, that's, I think.
But
that's
I felt true. Like I had to defend potsherds.
Oh, my dissertation's on potsherds, and I also love hieroglyphs. So.
But it's true in a number of places where they have a written record and it's been translated, and they have an archaeological record where when the things don't mesh precisely, the argument then becomes one of, but the written record is more significant. No, the material record is more significant.
And we don't have any more time, but there are some very famous Maya examples we could kind of walk through.
Well, we're probably going to be touching on this as we go through other topics that we have planned for the future. So we will definitely be coming back around to this. But guys, thank you very much for being on the show this evening.
Absolutely. Great.
Thank you.
Fun.
Yeah, this feels a little like an intro.
This has inspired me. Inspired me, though, now. Because what I want to do is, you know how I know the Mac operating system has a few dozen different languages you can program your keyboard to write in. I'm waiting for them to develop a Maya hieroglyph keyboard so I can write directly in Maya on my computer.
I have seen fonts, but they don't work that way. They're right. Straight.
But they look pretty.
Yeah, we can
put these in the show notes, and there are any number of books I could sell out there, but there's a few basic ones that I would just want to recommend. First of all, I mentioned FAMSI. If you want to read a fantastic take on made for a popular audience as well as an academic audience on this decipherment, Breaking the Maya Code by Mike Coe. He also co-authored with Mark Stone Reading the Maya Glyphs, which is a solid core intro. There are lots of Egyptian ones like this. This is a solid core intro one. On if you want to take a crack at Maya yourself, there's another one by a friend of mine, Scott Johnson, translating Maya hieroglyphs. If you want to take a look at the artwork and the glyphs, Reading Maya Art, A Hieroglyphic Guide to Ancient Maya Painting and Sculpture by Andrea Stone and Mark Zender, again, made for a popular audience but with rigor, is really cool. And then one that I always recommend and I buy for my students occasionally, Chronicle of the Maya Kings and Queens by Simon Martin and Nikolai Gruba. Again, it's made for a popular audience, yet scholars turn to it all the time. It is, in essence, the who's who of Maya kings and queens and nobles organized. Not every single one of them, but like the core major cities. These are all relatively low cost. And frankly, you could probably get all of them like used for, because they've had multiple editions, for very small amounts of money. I highly recommend all of these. If this is some, as well as FAMSI, if this is something that you're interested in, because it is a thing that people like to just get into a bit, both Egyptian and Maya hieroglyphs, and play around with, and I would recommend it.
I want to give a shout out to my dad, who died in 2012. The guy was a brilliant man, linguist, multilingual, and when he retired, he decided to learn Egyptian hieroglyphs, and he did. I bought him a book on Maya hieroglyphs, and I sent it to him. I said, Dad, so does your knowledge of Egyptian hieroglyphs help you with this at all? And my dad called me on the phone, and he said, Kenny, I have no fucking idea what these Maya are trying to do. So, yeah, which, by the way, is anybody who says that, well, the Egyptian hieroglyphs inspired the Maya writing system, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
There's no connection there. Guys, thank you very much for being on the show, and I'm sure we'll come back around to this again, and you guys have a good evening.
Reptiles as one will call. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. Our music was provided by Archaeosuit Productions. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Stitcher and share us wherever you use social media. You can contact us with your questions, comments, or angry email at archaeofantasies@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeofantasies. You can follow the blog at www.archaeofantasies.com and get updates on Tumblr and Twitter at @archaeofantasies. You can also look for us on Facebook. If you're looking for the show notes for this episode, go to the podcast website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeofantasies. Thanks again for listening.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. We don't do dinosaurs.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle.
And edited by Richie Cruz.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.